Let me begin by indicating that today is March 9th, 1995. This is Jim Boning speaking with Bruce Hannay in the Harbor Court Hotel in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Hannay, I know that you were born on the 9th of February in 1921. Could you tell me something about your father and mother and your family background?
Well, I was born in a small town in the state of Washington, and my father and his parents and his brothers and sisters had descended from a Scottish family which came to Nova Scotia, and after a few years there they said it wasn't any better than Scotland as far as the climate, so they started migrating west, and they spent a little time in Chicago where my father was born, and then they lived in South Dakota for a while, and finally they came to the state of Washington, where my father, leading the family, acquired a small town bank, or one that was just starting, and because he was a banker by profession, and so were the rest of his father and his brothers, and so that was his business in this small town, Mount Vernon, Washington, and it was a successful bank and it's a rapidly growing region. I might comment that the thing that really gave that part of the country a big boost was the Alaska Gold Rush, and people came out there and they poured through the state of Washington because that was the closest point to getting to Alaska to dig for gold. So all the towns grew, Seattle grew, everything grew. My mother was the offspring of a family of pioneers that had come from southern Indiana, and she was born in the state of Washington in 1887, before Washington was a state. And I'll tell you, the first settlement in Seattle was, I think, 1859. So she was a real pioneer.
I'll say.
And her ancestors came from the Daniel Boone family in southern Indiana, Kentucky, across the river from southern Indiana. And so we lived there, and it was pleasant being born and spending my early years in a small town. But when the Depression came along, a bank where its business was largely mortgages on farms that were owned by the Swedish farmers who had left Minnesota because they were too crowded there, and they all came out to Skagit County in the state of Washington, and they all had mortgages. And my father said, there's no way we're going to foreclose any of these mortgages. These are honest people. They'll pay it back when they have the money. But he couldn't float it because of the money requirements. So he sold the bank. I might say his father was working in the bank, and his brothers working in the bank, and his brother-in-law was working in the bank. But he sold the bank to the National Bank of Commerce in Seattle, a large bank, which had a bunch of better capitalization. And he became an officer of that bank, and we moved to Seattle. And that was fine, except that my father was killed in an accident soon after we got there. So my mother had three sons of varying ages from high school on down. I was the youngest. And she was left with the job of bringing up three boys. And she did it. So I lived in Seattle through my high school years. Okay. I was the youngest. I was the last to leave. When I used to college, first time I ever crossed the Mississippi River was going east to college.
Oh, really?
In the outskirts of Philadelphia.
Well, I wanted to, just for a moment, talk about, you received your grade school education in Mount Vernon then.
Part of it.
But most of your
education.
The first
half of it, yeah.
Was in Seattle.
Yeah, well, I got through maybe the fourth grade or something like that in Mount Vernon. And then I went to Seattle and got the rest of the grammar school education and high school.
Okay. And during your high school career, I noticed that on this form you've mentioned that both your second brother and your high school chemistry teacher had an influence on you.
Well, the teacher was very good. It was one of the public high school, Garfield High School in Seattle. And the teacher, I was pretty bright student, and chemistry teacher, one in particular, but actually both of them, I think there were two, were very encouraging. When I remember that they asked all the students, maybe just the juniors and seniors, to go around to little classes once a year where they could spend a couple of hours hearing about a profession. And they'd invite somebody in from the local community to tell them what it's like. I just assumed I'd be a banker. Everybody in my family is a banker. And I went around and I listened to the one in banking and so forth. But by the time I finished high school, I'd been so enamored of the possibility of going into chemistry because these teachers were so careful to cultivate my incipient interest, which began to emerge taking all the courses in, offered in high school. In fact, they offered me a chance to go to courses that weren't even listed as courses and just go and work in the back room and do experiments and study ahead and learn things. And so it was really quite nice because they saw that I could get through the assigned work in the chemistry classes. And the people in mathematics did the same thing, and to some extent in physics, but it was very encouraging. So I always felt that they, well, for example, why did I become a chemist rather than a physicist when I ended up later being at least as much of a physicist as chemist? It was simply because those teachers were more open in their cultivation. So I regarded them as being very important. My older brother, the oldest one, had gone off. He was going, taking a job and lived far away, but the next one down was a very scholarly one. He spent a lot of time trying to encourage me to learn things and do things and so forth. So it was, I'd say, it was very fortunate.
Was this a large high school?
Oh, yes, it was a big public high school. Seattle at that time, I think, had a population of, I don't know, 360,000 or something, and there were 9 public high schools. And these had something like 3,000 students. And my high school had the most diverse collection of people, racially, and, well, that was good. You know, there were a lot of black students, and there were Oriental students, and it was fine. We all got along very well. But it was a good school to go to, Garfield High School. And people who went there now, I run into them from time to time, not the ones that I knew then. And I think that all of the people who went to that place are proud to claim it as their high school.
Your other brother, your older brothers, had gone on to college, so I was assuming.
Yeah, they went to the University of Washington.
Was it sort of foregone you would be doing the same thing then? Why did you choose Swarthmore if you were admitted to Caltech?
Well, Caltech had a tremendous reputation in science, but I thought that Swarthmore would provide a more broadly based liberal education. Also, it was coeducational, which sounded like a good idea, because I was shy with girls, and I thought that maybe it would be good to be exposed to girls. Although, as it turned out, Swarthmore allowed one to specialize so much. I think I would have gotten more liberal arts courses if I'd gone to Caltech than I did get at Swarthmore, where I I took chemistry, physics, and mathematics until I was coming out of my ears.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought that. I'm curious as to why your brother thought Swarthmore was the finest.
Oh,
did he have any connection with it?
No, we had none at all. There were no Quakers in the family. But you could read articles. And we read articles about... And small liberal arts colleges were mentioned prominently, and invariably Swarthmore was either the top one that was named or in the top two or three, and the others were, I'm sure, very good. Haverford, another place of college, but that was all men. I mean, I could name some more. Carleton in Minnesota and Reed College in Oregon was a possibility, and maybe one or two others. But Swarthmore was always up there, and usually named number one. So I thought that I ought to go there.
How did you finance going to Swarthmore?
Well, things didn't cost as much in those days, and I had a small scholarship, but my father had left enough for my mother to take care of things pretty well, and so we paid for it.
You said it was the first time you crossed the Mississippi was going to Philadelphia. How did you make that trip alone, and how did you react to Philadelphia when you got there?
Well, I had my oldest brother was now working in Texas, and the middle one of the three of us was in graduate school, and he was probably at Stanford at that time. But during the summers, my mother was eager to see her oldest son. And we spent a lot of time driving around. We just get in the family car and go for a trip. We'd drive down to Texas to see my brother. And nobody had any pressing obligations. So I'd been around as far as Texas, but I'd never been as far as the Mississippi River. And so when the time came for me to start at Swarthmore, my middle brother, by that time, was a graduate student at Princeton in economics. So we took the family car and just kept going, and I had my stuff in the back of the car, and my mother was on trip. She wanted to see where I was going to school, and so the two of them dropped me off at Swarthmore. My mother shed a few tears, leaving me to the tender mercy of the East. And I believe it was probably her first time over in the East. But I was sort of excited by it. You know, I'd heard of these places like New York and Philadelphia and Baltimore and Washington and Boston. Never seen them or been anywhere near them. Hadn't even been to Chicago. And so it was all very exciting.
That was 1938?
That was 38, yes. 1938.
What was Swarthmore like when you started there at that time?
Well, one thing about it was that we had very distinguished president of that school, Frank Adelot, and he was a famous American educator, and that's why Swarthmore was also at the top of these lists. He later became head of the American Rhodes Scholar Committee and director of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. But he had, this was part of my reason for choosing Swarthmore, he had instituted a program of study called the Honors Program there. You take courses, everybody took courses for the first 2 years. And then, generally speaking, the top half of the students, or probably pretty close to half, would only take two subjects at a time each semester, and they'd have seminars that might last all afternoon, or they might last a good part of the day, and it would be a small group of people, maybe 6-7 students, meeting with the professor. And it wasn't an assistant professor or somebody else, it was the professor. And you'd meet with him, and he'd pick your brains and cram things into your head. And it was an informal setting, and Well, you really learn things that way because he was giving you individual attention. We had a teacher-to-student ratio of maybe six.
Wow.
And these were professors. They were smart people who loved teaching because they weren't hired because they were great research scientists. They could have done research, but they loved teaching. And, well, that was good. You know, like if you went to a large school at that time, there'd be a big lecture, and the professor might give it once a week. In fact, when I was later a graduate student at Princeton, I became an assistant. I had a scholarship that got me teaching physics. I'd go once a week because to the lecture that the professor gave, and he had a student group of 100 people or so. He gave a lecture for an hour. That's what they saw of him. Mm-hmm. And then they would break up into smaller groups, like 20 or 25. I was a graduate student in chemistry, and I was teaching these kids, freshmen, physics in groups like that. I was only a graduate student in chemistry, so, you know, that's quite different from the Swarthmore style. I'm not knocking Princeton. It was a great very good place, but just saying that Swarthmore gave attention to the students, which was remarkable. And when I finished Swarthmore and went to Princeton, and Princeton is a good university and it was well known in chemistry, I knew everything that they taught in first year courses. And I started with just a couple of the second year courses because I knew everything in some of the second year courses in chemistry. So I was ready for my PhD exam, the written exam, after 1 year at Princeton.
That's quite a testament then to your training at Swarthmore.
At Swarthmore.
Yeah. Who were some of the chemistry faculty?
Well, the chairman of the department was H. Germain Maud Creighton, C-R-E-I-G-H-T-O-N, and he was a well-known electrochemist, and he gave the freshman chemistry lectures at that time, and we all remembered he paced back and forth from the lecture hall as he talked. Once in a while he stopped and liked something, but he went back and forth, and some of the students would tick it off on them. They wanted to know how many times during the course of the hour lecture he went back and forth. There was a younger one who was a PhD in chemistry. His name was Walter B. Keighton, K-E-I-G-H-T-O-N. And he is just remarkable in his devotion to teaching the students, and he had a great influence on it. There was another fellow, the organic chemistry professor, whose name was Edward Cox. And he was a tough fellow, and he wanted everybody to do better than they were already doing, and he stuck it to us. I didn't want to be an organic chemist, but boy, he was, those were the three principal ones. There was an analytical chemist, but, you know, those are the three big names.
What were the laboratory facilities like?
Not bad. They were an old building, you know, built in the Dark Ages, and the laboratory stuff was not new and not remarkable, but it was very adequate. And so we had plenty of laboratory work. But the professor would come to the laboratory. I mean, anyway, didn't send it. It wasn't a graduate student there telling you what to do. The way when I was at Princeton, I sometimes assisted in the chemistry labs, but you know, the professor wasn't there. But these guys had come in a white coat to the laboratory, and they were going around looking over everybody's shoulders. So I felt that they did an outstanding teaching job, and I couldn't speak more highly of the quality of the education at Swarthmore.
You said you took a lot of physics and math at the same time.
Yeah, when you arrived at Swarthmore, they said, you know what you want to major in? And I was not Well, I was pretty sure I wanted to be a chemistry major, but I wasn't. And the system was a chemistry major only started physics in the second year. I wanted to start physics right then and there. So I told Professor Creighton I didn't know whether I wanted to be a chemistry or a physics major, distorting the truth a little bit. So he said, well, then what, you ought to take physics, introductory physics, in your freshman year so that you could go either way, which is just what I wanted. So I started with both physics and chemistry. I guess my interest in physics increased a great deal while I was there because it was a assistant, he probably was an associate professor by the time I moved. His name was Elmore, and he was just as good as these chemistry professors that is working with the student. And so I found him an outstanding teacher, and the mathematics professors were outstanding. So I was enjoying myself thoroughly in all this. But when I finally started a working career after graduate school and went to Bell Labs, I found myself doing mostly physics. And then I sort of regretted that I hadn't been a physics major, but that was all right.
I'm intrigued by your comment earlier that you didn't get that much in the liberal arts.
Well, you can see how, if I was taking physics instead of some liberal arts course, mm-hmm. And working it to take more mathematics and more physics and more chemistry than were really in the book, there was only so much time during the day. Also, this honor system where you just had the two seminars, you should have gotten your liberal arts courses in your first 2 years, your freshman and sophomore years. I took them what was required, which is to learn German, and I had to take something in the humanities, so I took a year of English, and that was about it. Mm. My liberal arts consisted of two semesters of English courses, I picked out a couple, and German, and the rest of the time I was taking chemistry, physics, and mathematics.
Well, that means you had the flexibility to make those choices.
That's right.
Okay. A number of liberal arts schools, you don't have all that flexibility.
That's true. That's true. And I'm not sure that Swarthmore would give it to anybody now, but mm-hmm. I worked the system to what I wanted to do at the time, and I think they probably were a little startled to find that I hadn't taken more things. And later on, and it would have been very nice to have done it, but I was in a great hurry to get out of my subject and get on to graduate school and so forth.
How many majors, chemistry majors, were there? Was it a large number?
Oh, I would guess that there were probably, and it started at the same time I did, there must have been about 15 or so. See, the classes at Swarthmore had maybe 800 or 900 students at that time, and the classes were all quite small. And I would say that that was about the number, and about half of them, of the chemistry students, that let's say the top half, went into this honors program, and the other half continued in regular courses in the same subjects that we were taking, but not with the same intensity and not at the same level. So while we remained friendly with them and knowing them as fellow students, the ones that I was in close association with were the, let's say, the eight or so who were in the chemistry honors program. And so I got to know those people very, very well. We spent all our time together because we were supposed to take the same things. They would take the same physics seminars, the same mathematics seminars, so we knew each other pretty well.
Did you get much laboratory experience during the seminar time?
Yes. They had laboratories, and they didn't neglect that. I'd say that the typical one in physical chemistry or organic chemistry, we would have one morning or afternoon a week in a seminar session. So that might be up to 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And then there would be a laboratory once a week, and we'd spend the whole afternoon in it, let's say from 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock. And that was true in physical chemistry, it's true in analytical chemistry, it's true in organic chemistry, it was true in physics. So we had full quota of laboratory experience.
Did you have a chance to do any independent research?
Well, not really, although some of the teachers had encouraged us to do a little bit more than the prescribed thing. I mean, they were trying to have a kind of an open-ended thing and would encourage us to do such things as go look up in the literature what here's something you want to synthesize or something you want to do. Why don't you go read about it and find out what the way to do it, and then come and tell me so that we didn't waste our time on a dead end or blow ourselves up or something. But that isn't independent research. They were encouraging us to be independent in our thinking, but they didn't. Set us to work on a long project. We had to pause, of course. That didn't happen. I guess later on it did, but it wasn't the fashion at that time.
The war started, I guess, you were in your junior year.
The war started, and I can remember exactly where I was, and the young girl who was studying with me one evening in the chemistry library, and who had been my wife since not too long after that, and I were studying, we were the only ones in there, when one of the other chemistry majors and his girl, one he's married to now, came into the library, and they looked kind of ashen, and they said, "Did you hear the news?" "No, what's the news?" And they told us about Pearl Harbor. They just heard it on the radio. Mm. And that was in December of our junior year. No, that was December of our senior year, because that was 1941, and I graduated in 42, so it was December of our senior year.
Okay. What effect did this have? I mean, were you worried about being drafted at that point?
Yes, I went to of course, I had a draft going, and both my brothers had been drafted. But first students, we were of an age that they weren't drafting us yet, and I went up and started at Princeton, only about the length of time that it takes to take the train up to get from one place to the other, and I started at Princeton. And then I was quickly swept in on, had a student deferment at first, and then they started drafting everybody. But the work that I was doing, and I had already started my thesis work, was considered worthy of deferment, because it related to the synthetic rubber program. But then, partway through my graduate work, I was swept in on the Manhattan Project. And that was the chairman of the chemistry department at Princeton was a big wheel in the Manhattan Project.
Was that Hugh Taylor?
That was Hugh Taylor.
Okay.
That part of it, which was called the K-25 Project, which was the Oak Ridge gaseous diffusion, was at Columbia University at the Kellogg Corporation, which was something derived from the Kellogg Company, mm-hmm. MW, I think was that the initials right. And there was Hugh Taylor had all the graduate students working on it in chemistry that he could get, and he was a hard driver. He wasn't my thesis professor, but one of the stories about him, we were doing our Manhattan Project work in one of the freshman laboratories or something, a big laboratory, you know, and every one of the graduate students had a piece of real estate in that place. And he came in one night. There were 12 of us, I think, that were using that laboratory. And he came in one night at midnight. He'd just come back from Columbia or Kellogg. And he looked around, and there were 6 people working hard at work. He said, "Where is everybody?" So that was the style. I tell you, we really worked hard. And when I finally moved to Bell Labs, they had a small group, but a talented group working in the Manhattan Project. I transferred up there working in the same area that I had. And another thing that isn't generally known, the material, the diffusion barrier that was finally used at Oak Ridge, and which allowed them to separate U-235 and U-238, was at Bell Labs. It was not done at Columbia or Kellex or Princeton. It was done at Bell Labs.
Okay.
They've never wanted to advertise it particularly because some people are, they didn't want to associate the telephone company with such a fearsome weapon. But in fact, it was a Bell Labs. I don't mean the idea of having a diffusion barrier, but the particular metallurgical processes and so forth were the idea of somebody at Bell Labs, and we worked on it together. And my job was I was measuring the reaction rate between uranium hexafluoride and these barriers. So I had a big tank of chlorine of about 2,000 pounds pressure in my lab. And I'll tell you what a kind of amusing story on that comes to mind. I had a canned pressure tank of uranium hexafluoride, and where I get the uranium hexafluoride is to go up to SAM lab, special alloy materials or something. That was the code for the place up at, I forgot whether it was at Columbia or at Kellex. And I'd get the thing filled. But I wasn't given limousine to go up in or something. I took a bus from Bell Labs, which was about 30 miles west of New York. I took a bus to Summit, New Jersey. Got off that, took the Lackawanna Railroad to Hoboken, took the what we called the tube, the Hudson and Manhattan Tube, over to 33rd Street and 6th Avenue, changed to the IRT, and took that up to Columbia University, went in with the can, and they would fill it, and then I reversed the whole thing. So it was the better part of a day, and that's the way I got the supply of uranium hexafluoride. Well, I was coming back one time from this, and I was sitting on the IRT, and I began to smell uranium hexafluoride. The valve on my little tank obviously was defective. Not badly, but enough so that I smell something, and I was pretty sure it was sulfur hexafluoride. Well, hey, what am I going to do? Here I am, a young new employee, and I'm leaking uranium hexafluoride into a subway car in the IRT. Well, being cowardly, I just went on with it and went right through that whole procedure. I didn't call the police or anything, and got in. When I finally got out to Murray Hill, I attached it to my system and so forth, and then that put a stop to the leakage out. But Holy crow. I've told that story to people, you know, about sitting there working in an ad project with a leaking tank of uranium hexafluoride, and people are sort of aghast.
That's amazing. Let me come back a little bit. Your brother, I think, has gone on to Princeton. First of all, when did you decide you wanted to go on for the PhD, or was that
I just sort of assumed it. Okay. I would. He encouraged me to do it. My oldest brother did. My middle brother was himself working for a PhD, and he didn't finish it, by the way, because the war interfered and he didn't have the heart to go in and finish it. He got partway through the program. Also, he was kind of an intellectual. I shouldn't use the word dilettante, but he was interested in so many things that he didn't concentrate. I had a much stronger interest in concentrating on a target.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were after him all the time to, you know, get on with it and start your thesis and so forth. And he could always find ways to go off on side issues. So he didn't finish it. And that was too bad, because he had the brains to do it, but he didn't have the drive. My oldest brother was he went into commercial activities right away, and he wasn't the student that the other two of us were, and had no interest in doing that. Not that he wasn't intelligent and successful, but he was much more conventional in his ambitions about how he wanted to spend his working life.
And had you selected Princeton because of your brother, or was...
No. At that time, I had made up my mind I was going to be in physical chemistry, not organic chemistry. And so I had advice and my own observations as to which were the top universities in the country, graduate schools, in physical chemistry. And the list would have been somewhat different if it had been organic chemistry. Those are the two primary... Lots more people took organic than took physical chemistry. I mean, if you're going to be an organic chemist, you might have said, well, the University of Illinois, which is running over with stars in organic chemistry, but not in physical chemistry. And Princeton and Caltech and MIT and maybe Harvard, they were the top schools, graduate schools in physical chemistry, and I, somewhat influenced by the size of the fellowship I could get at each one, and so on, and I kind of liked the looks at Princeton. Well, I was also very impressed with the reputation of Henry Eyring, who was a theoretical chemist. You're a chemist.
I'm a chemist.
Yeah, well, you know Eyring.
Yes.
Henry Eyring was at Princeton at that time, and I found him a dazzling figure.
Mm-hmm.
So I went there thinking that when it came time to do a thesis, I would do it with Henry Eyring. He gently steered me away from that, or told me to wait a while and make up my mind, and I ended up doing my thesis with Charlie Smythe.
Oh.
But Hugh Taylor had a big reputation in catalysis, and Henry Eyring, and there were... But an organic chemist, I would say, you should not have gone to Princeton at that time, because there were people who were respectable organic chemists, but that wasn't the thing that was interesting. By all odds, it was physical chemistry at Princeton.
What was it about physical chemistry that attracted you rather than organic?
Well, probably the this incipient interest in physics, too. Well, I don't know. And it looked to me as though in organic chemistry there were large numbers of people went in, and at that point in time I hadn't particularly thought about whether industry or an academic career was of interest in, but it just seemed to me that there were more exciting opportunities that might come my way, exciting to me. And don't misunderstand me, I have great respect for the organic chemists, and they've done a tremendous job over the years, but it just makes you choice.
Mm-hmm. So when you arrived in Princeton in 42, you said quickly after you left Swarthmore, you had a teaching assistantship. Was that the first position you had?
Yeah, it was. Well, and the first year of graduate work, the people with the assistantships were helpers in the lab. We'd attend the lectures, but we'd help in the lab. We didn't teach sections or anything. But then I got a fellowship that was the Allied Chemical and Dye Fellowship, which I never took up because it came around, I guess Hugh Taylor came around and said that the physics department needed teachers because all of the professors were at Los Alamos. Mm-hmm. He didn't mention Los Alamos, but he said they were all away. But I found out after I got over there, there really were, I think, only one or two professors left, and everybody else was in Los Alamos, including the instructors or people who might teach the sections. And so they were rounding up graduate students out of other departments who might be qualified to teach sections. And they wouldn't have gotten particularly an organic chemist because he wouldn't have been interested enough in physics, but I hadn't had enough physics and was interested in physical chemistry, so they got me over there. And one of the remaining physics professors was giving the lectures. They were once a week kind of thing. He was an outstanding lecturer. But then I had a couple of sections, and I would meet with them, I've forgotten whether it was two or three times a week. And we would review the things that had been covered in the lecture and there were problems and all kinds of things, and they'd ask questions. This is where there was an interactive session. And I would suppose there were probably 20 to 25 people in the session, and they were freshmen. I was, by that time, probably a second-year graduate student. But they were either Princeton freshmen, regular, or they came out with one of the military programs. The ASTP, which was, I forgot what it was, but they were Army. And then there was the Navy program, the V-12 program. So you got, they had, let's say, different capabilities for different backgrounds in their high school. So it wasn't an identical job teaching. I taught the Princeton freshman for a while. And then I went over and taught the Army, you know, ASTP program, but not the Navy people. That was just, you know, we got divided up. And they divided the students up alphabetically, and I had a class that I think half of the people were named Moskowitz. I had all the M's. Everybody in the section had a name beginning with M.
You said that some of your first thesis work was on the had to do with the synthetic rubber program.
Yeah.
Well, that was Smythe at that point?
That was with Smythe, yes. Because I actually started it when I first got there in a mild kind of a way. But I was measuring dipole moments and the electronic structure of molecules, and the particular topic that we agreed on in the set had to do with unsaturated compounds of the butadiene class, or derivatives of butadiene and so forth, and there was the electronic structure of those because of the resonance, as they called it then, between various electronic structures. You kind of artificially would end up saying, well, you've got a certain amount of this and that, you know, where are the electrons in there and why does it have the dipole moment as? And so I measured a whole bunch of those things, but these were materials that were used in the synthetic rubber program or related to it, isoprene and the whole bunch. So by stretching things, well, you know, the rubber program didn't depend upon my work, far from it, but it was work on a class of compounds, trying to understand them, that had a great, not just commercial potential, but actually defense work, because it was related to the synthetic rubber program. So that got me deferred for a while, anyway.
You had mentioned that Eyring, you wanted to work with Eyring, but he steered you away. May I ask why?
Well, I don't know. You have to ask Henry. Henry's, I took quantum mechanics and statistical mechanics from him. He probably figured I wasn't smart enough or something. But anyway, he wasn't convinced that I knew what I was doing. So while we were extremely friendly and I enjoyed his classes and got along very well with him, and I think I learned a lot from him, in looking back on it, I was much better off with Charlie Smythe. But I think it's very hard for a student at that age to see very clearly what you really should do. You're too much influenced by the man himself and so forth, and Eyring had this big reputation, and so but I wouldn't have wanted to be an Eyring student in the long run. Charlie Smythe was a marvelous person to do a thesis with. He was such a fine person, such a gentleman. I learned a lot from him, but he wasn't flashy the way Eyring was. So I think Eyring did me a favor. I'm not going to go on. Sorry, the best I was. So I was pleased with my association with Eyring, but it was strictly in the classroom context. He was quite a teacher, too. Charlie was... He was a great name, too, in chemistry, because there wasn't anybody in the world who was better known in the measurement of dipole moments and the determination of molecular structure through the dipole moment measurement. And so he had a succession of graduate students who had... You'd take a particular class of compounds, the way I had these conjugated diene structures, and sort of work your way through that with whatever suggested itself to see if you could work out a coherent explanation of the effects of where the electrons were and so forth, and other people had done other things. And another thing I did with him was he was very interested in knowing whether somebody couldn't measure the dipole moment of hydrogen fluoride. Hydrogen iodide, hydrogen bromide, and hydrogen chloride had been measured. And Linus Pauling had derived from those three a formula for electronegativity, an electronegativity scale. But nobody had ever been able to measure hydrogen fluoride because it would chew up the apparatus. Well, the opportunity came when I was a graduate student with Charlie, because Teflon was invented, I guess, at DuPont. And so that finally there was an insulator that wouldn't be attacked by hydrogen fluoride. So Charlie suggested that I go to work on hydrogen fluoride. And we drew up a little cell which could be in the system that could be used to insert the cell into the apparatus that was going to measure the... You're basically measuring a dielectric constant. And took advantage of the fact that he could use his connections and get some Teflon. And that was the insulator that we use to separate the electrodes. We have to have two electrodes. There's no getting around that. So we did this, and I measured it, hydrogen fluoride, and he was astonished because it was way off from what had been expected from the extrapolation of the other three. And he was too nice a fellow to tell me that I had made a mistake or something. But when I left, we wrote a paper
But it is obvious that he was still suspicious of it. So he got the student who came along and inherited all my laboratory and equipment and so forth while I had gone off to Bell Labs. He got him to measure it, and he got precisely the same number. So that I felt relieved. But what this did was to, we wrote a paper which far more people read and paid attention to than any of this stuff on the strictly organic things, because we essentially provided a new formula for electronegativity, different from the Linus Pauling one, because we had, it was one of these things where you have three things that didn't change all that much, and then hydrogen fluoride were way up here because it was so extraordinarily different. You badly needed that one in order to say what shape is the curve. It's pretty hard to find it from three points that aren't, that are clearly not linear, but anyway, that was the offshoot of the thing. I'm pleased to have participated in that with Charlie.
Well, Teflon had been, was discovered in 38, but it found its first use, it was more of a curiosity until wartime, so
that's right.
His knowing that had to come out of the wartime effort only.
Well, it came out of that, and you see, everybody there, Princeton Chemistry Department, one way or another, involved with the Manhattan Project,
That's fascinating. You then switched over to the Manhattan Project. What year would that have been?
Well, that's sort of murky. It was. I gradually got involved in Manhattan Project activities while I was a graduate student, after I'd really finished the thesis.
Okay.
But I hadn't gotten a PhD yet, because Hugh Taylor wouldn't give it to me, because he said, you can't come in here and expect to get a PhD in that short of time here. You've got to put in your time. I said, well, this, I thought that there was, he was a great believer in the English Oxford-Cambridge kind of system, where I said, I thought what you had learned and whether you could satisfy the examiners. Well, he didn't want this to be some place where an upstart from Swarthmore could come in and breeze through in some time, so he wouldn't get it to me. And you couldn't, if you didn't have that, and he had to sign a release to get me to move out of Princeton. So there we were in an impasse for a while, but I was started to work in the Manhattan Project at Princeton. But as I explained to you earlier, what was going on at Bell Labs was part of the same project that Hugh Taylor was on. And in fact, I have to say that the work at Princeton had less of a focus and led to less than the work at Bell Labs. So I got myself hired. I went around and got interviewed and got hired at Bell Labs, but I couldn't get a release to move. And the fellow who hired me, who was the chemical director at Bell Labs, Robert M. Burns, R.M. Burns. He laughed about this, and he got a hold of Taylor and so forth, and he said, well, we'll put him to work on the Manhattan Project when he comes up here, so he just continued doing that. So Taylor, that pulled the rug out from under Taylor's assertion that I was being disloyal to the country. So finally, he just got sick of me, and he signed it, and I could leave. And I went up to Bell Labs, still in the Manhattan Project. And so that transition was made that way.
That was 44.
Yes.
So as it was, you got your degree, your PhD, in 2 years.
Yeah, and people in those days, they spent a lot of time working. This midnight story was, we worked. Mm-hmm. It was 7 days a week and around the clock. So there was no goofing off. But I would say that the Swarthmore experience had certainly saved at least a year, because all the other people starting graduate school took the first of the graduate courses. And I started to go, I sat in on them. And another thing about Taylor, he lied, there were no grades or anything in the graduate courses.
you just sit in fact, audit the course. And I sat in and I said, holy smoke, I've covered all this way back in when I was a junior at Swarthmore, so why should I sit through these lectures? Mm-hmm. I already know all this. So I moved on to the more advanced courses, and I give Swarthmore credit for having exposed me to the this material before I got to Princeton.
It was Hugh Taylor who got you into the Manhattan Project then?
Yes. I think it was Charles Smith who suggested that I should go over and help those people.
Okay.
But I'm sure Hugh Taylor was in effect drafting the graduate student. Here's a guy that's on the list, let's put him to work on something that Hugh Taylor really cared about. And Hugh Taylor didn't care about dipole moments. I mean, Hugh Taylor was he's a very patriotic fellow, and he was pushing very hard to get the Manhattan Project, his part of it, successfully advanced. And yeah, I ended up being quite good friends with Hugh Taylor, but at that time it was a kind of a touchy relationship because I was throwing him inside. But Hugh Taylor was he was a very good scientist, but he was a pretty hard-headed fellow. I mean, he was convinced that he was right about things. He wasn't very flexible.
He came up to Bell Labs once when I had been up there for several years, and he came up and filmed me to show him some of the work in chemistry, and he almost exploded. He said, but you people got your head in the clouds up here. You're doing all this basic research. You're not working on products. So I thought, the university professor coming and accusing us of being too basic in our research, and why aren't we doing something that's immediately apparent as a useful activity? But
were you aware when you started the work on the gaseous diffusion, were you aware of the ultimate goal of the Manhattan Project?
Well, graduate students talk among each other and compare notes and so forth, and they were very careful. They never talked about Los Alamos, and they never talked about Oak Ridge and so forth. There was location X and there was location Y and so forth. And but professors had dropped little hints and so forth. And so we put our heads together, and you know, we had a pretty good idea of what it was, but I think we were as surprised as anyone when it actually came to pass. And I guess it was Hiroshima that brought it to our attention, just like everybody else. But so we had a pretty good inkling about it, but we didn't have any information whatsoever about what was being done at other places except the ones that I mentioned. You know, I didn't know that Oak Ridge and Los Alamos were involved. I didn't know anything about these places. I didn't know that there was a project in Hanford, because there were different things that were being pursued. We had the gaseous diffusion project, but then there was a Y-12 project or something. Mm-hmm. That was essentially an electromagnetic separation using a spectrometer, if you'd like, that was separating out the isotopes. Nobody knew how to. Now here we were working on trying to make these miles and miles and miles of tubing that would do it. All of them were pretty fanciful at that time, and at least those two that I mentioned ended up as being part of the final process. So I really wasn't completely aware of it, but neither were we completely ignorant of what was going on. But they certainly they had a tight security. They were not mentioning lightly what we were going to do.
Were you cautioned about not saying anything to anybody about what you were doing?
Probably in a mild way. I was certainly said it was a secret project, shouldn't be talked about. but they gave us so little information, we really didn't know much of anything except what we were really working on. So I guess the caution was heard and observed. After all, we were aware of the fact that there was a war on. I had two brothers who were getting shot at, and I would say that the attitude of the graduate students that I saw and the people on it was one of total cooperation with the whole thing. There wasn't any looseness in the way they approached the
security. There wasn't any attempt on anybody's part to say, is this thing what society needs or anything.
We were in war. And when we finished, the project was successful. I think all of us were very proud of having been part of it. And I am today proud of it. And the people who think it was wicked to have done that, well, they didn't know about how many 100,000 people would have gotten killed going into Japan. So I just disagree with the protesters completely. It's misguided.
That's just this recent business with the Enola Gay exhibit, the Smithsonian, is a, mm-hmm. a good example of that.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Well, and there was some of that that was going on at the time, but not at our low level, because after all, you know, Oppenheimer and other people had great willingness to pass information to the Russians. I haven't heard of anybody passing it to the Nazis, but they were certainly sympathetic to the Russian. Mm-hmm. And of course it ended up that almost immediately after the end of the war we found out where we stood with them. In fact, my boss at Bell Labs, and I wouldn't put this in any account, but he said when the end of the war came, he was working on that project too. In fact, he was the one who conceived the nature of the metallurgical process that produced this successful barrier. And when the Hiroshima bomb had been dropped in Nagasaki and then the end of the war came, he said, if we had any sense now, and it'll never come to pass because the country wouldn't do it, what we should do is to go around and drop one on the Russians right now, and we'd save a lot of trouble later on. He was saying that in to startle us and to be humorous, but I often thought afterwards, you know, that we, at that time, for a brief period, we had it and they didn't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did you initiate the contact with Bell Labs?
No, Charlie Smyth did.
Oh, okay.
Charlie Smyth and Sal, well, where are you going to go to work? And I said, I want to go to the industrial laboratory. And there were only... This was during the war, and a lot of them were not really doing research. I thought I wanted to do research, real research. And we talked it over and came up with a list of three places that I was interested in. And one was DuPont, and one was Shell Development in Emeryville, because there had been some exceedingly good work done by some people I knew about out there, catalysis and so forth. And the third one was Bell Labs. I knew less about them. Well, I when interviews, so it was really Charlie who got me straightened out on this, and I was interviewed at all three. But the one at Shell gave the show away because one of the people that I saw during the course of the day said, you know, none of us are doing research here. We're just all working on engineering projects because of the war. See, that was during the war, still was on. So. We washed out the Shell right away, and I went down to DuPont and visited two or three of their divisions. And they probably didn't want to make me an offer anyway. It didn't lead anywhere, but I went up to Bell Labs, where Burns mm-hmm. was chemical director, and he had gone through chemistry and got his PhD at Princeton. So this was the Princeton crowd at work. I went up there and I instantly knew this is the place I want to be. And they offered me a job, and I said to Burns, I'm very interested, but I said, is this a permanent job? Well, they're really only hiring people on a temporary basis to the end of the war. I said, I'm not interested. I don't want it. It's a permanent job or nothing. So we talked about that some more, and finally they offered me a job on a permanent basis. And I think that there were only three of us hired at Bell Labs as chemists during the war on that basis. The rest were laid off at the end of the war, you know, they said, okay, you've been in World War. But I didn't want to be, I had a greater desire for security in my employment than that. So even though I was working in the Manhattan Project, and that came to an end at the end of the war, then I went to work on Bell Labs work after that. And the other two also studied, but most of the people that got hired during the war left at the end of the war.
Well, that was 44, so there was, you were there at least a year working on the Manhattan Project when the war ended in 45.
Yeah, it was about a year, I guess.
Did you sense anything of the, to use a more pop, I guess a popular term, the culture of Bell Labs at that time, or was it overshadowed by the war effort?
No, I learned something of it, and so I certainly a lot more than I knew about it when I applied for a job there and got hired. And I discovered that there are all kinds of people around who, when you meet them, you didn't think, well, this guy. And then you discovered how bright they were. And you found out those are some of the brightest people you'll ever meet. But they were all very modest and unassuming. And so, I don't mean they all were, but you didn't get the impression of the intellectual power that was around the halls there until after you'd been there a while. And then you began to realize that you came in thinking you were pretty smart because you'd just gotten a fresh PhD from prestigious university, and so these people are obviously going to be impressed with you. But they'd come around and ask what you did, and then they'd ask me some questions about what did I think about this or that. And I'd say, gee, I can't even think about that subject. That's way beyond me. So I learned. Well, one of the things I learned was that something that reinforced in later years that Bell Labs was probably, and I think this is an honest and fair statement, the most widely admired industrial research laboratory in the world. And that doesn't mean it was necessarily, chemistry was its specialty, but it was a model for a lot of other companies that used to be a path to our door trying to find out what's the secret of your success. So I don't mean to imply that I knew all that when I was just being interviewed.
When the war ended, how quickly did things change?
Well, we got off the Manhattan Project pretty darn fast because and got on to Bell Labs work, and nothing changed. So I mean, people were leaving war work and getting back to telephone company work, and what took over then was the traditional Bell Labs approach to things. Things had been pretty well dictated by the needs of the war work during those years, but then it came back to being things that would help the telephone company, and Bell Labs had a very long-term view of that as to what was going to help the telephone company. And their tradition was to do things which had a long-range potential for helping the telephone company. They weren't pushing you to get a result this year or make a progress report every Friday afternoon. Mm-hmm. Nothing of the sort. And as the system became clearer to me over the years, and as I helped to, as I became an administrator of things, it was a good place to go And you had all kinds of freedom, but one of the freedoms was to hang yourself, in effect. They'd support you in all kinds of ways, but if you didn't see whether you could use those freedoms and so forth and that support, and if you couldn't, it was sort of, well, it's been nice knowing you. So we quietly separated plenty of people. But, so you either, it was like teaching a bunch of children to swim by throwing them all into the water. They'll either swim or they won't swim. And the ones who can't, I don't mean we let them drown in this, but at the Bell Labs, if they couldn't make it in that kind of environment, well, they had to have the initiative and an ability to produce in a competitive environment, but very cooperative environment. It's competitive in the sense that we wanted to be the best and to do well. It was a great place to be. I was extremely lucky. A lot of our people said they would have been happy to work there for nothing if they didn't have to eat, because it was so much fun. Great place.
What did Ray Boundy at Dow Chemical told me that he described the same thing in the 30s at Dow. Mm-hmm. But what he called it was accountable freedom, mm-hmm. the term he used.
Mm-hmm.
And you're essentially saying the same
thing. Yeah, I think that's right. I didn't know him, I met him. But it was, there was freedom. And they were tolerant about it, but eventually something had to come to pass. I mean, it didn't go on for 5 or 10 years. In fact, it later on, I really discovered and helped create a kind of a attitude on this. If somebody wasn't doing something that looked really worthwhile in 3 or 4 years after he came, he's better able to get another job when he can still coast on his professor's recommendations. If he spent 8 years with us and then the other potential employer said, what he did, well, he failed, and so we didn't want to be in that position, so we helped him find another spot. But so we had very high standards in what they'd have to do, but we give them an awful lot of freedom. As I say, almost the freedom to hang themselves, if that's what came most easily to them.
Manhattan Project stops. You go to looking at mechanisms of thermionic emission from the oxide cathodes.
The oxide cathode is the electron emitter in an electron tube, vacuum tube, as they were often called. And a man named Weinelt, obviously a German, had discovered in 1904, I may have missed it by a year, that the best coating for a thermionic emitter in one of those things was a mixture of alkaline earth oxides, notably barium, always some strontium, and occasionally sometimes some calcium in there. And now, here we were in 1945, 46, 47. We presumably a whole lot smarter than we'd been back in then. The vacuum tube had been hardly invented at the time that he discovered that. We couldn't believe that the very best thermionic emitter had been discovered in the really primitive days of the vacuum tube. Well, as it turns out, it had been. But I went to work to try to... Semiconductors were a hot new idea in physics. The Germans and Fred Seitz had talked about some of the defects in solids and so forth. That's a new concept for us and me and so forth, and we learned about semiconductors and holes and electrons and so forth, but it was in a primitive state because they weren't the semiconductors were compounds, like 2,6 compounds,
and nobody was quite sure of them. They didn't even know about NP type semiconductors. Well, so I set out to try to, but we had an idea, and it was really implanted in me by my boss, but it fell out of discussions that he and theoretical physicist had, who gave us some help and so forth, and we worked out a program trying to find out whether these oxide cathodes weren't semiconductors, because you could have explained things about their thermionic emission, not just from the low work function, the energy level difference to get an electron out of the interior of the solid and so forth. So I set out to do that, but these are powders, and boy, it was a messy business, and I was flailing away at this, making some progress and publishing a couple of papers and so forth, but it was kind of depressing at how you couldn't make single crystals or anything of the material. And I and a few other people around the world, some people in Holland, Bob Sproul was up at Cornell working on it, and a few others. The thing that the salvation came when some of our colleagues at Bell Labs invented the transistor, because at that point nobody was going to care anymore about the oxide cathode. We couldn't care less, and so the bandwagon was, and that was in germanium, and it was a great relief, because at that point it made my work obsolete. So I didn't have to continue. It had been moderately successful, but I'd have hated to spend my life trying to work on oxide cathodes. God, what a mess. Trying to measure things like Hall effect and so forth, and to learn the properties of the carriers. Yeah? No single crystals. Do you know Bob Sproul? Or
I know, yes.
Well, he was a graduate student of Cornell at that time, and he made the first single crystals of barium oxide, and maybe it was a solid solution of barium and strontium oxide. And he got some measurements made, but it was hard work for all of us. And so what happened then was that the first transistor was germanium. And it was not a single crystal, because the great genius had put together a group at Bell Labs of physicists at the end of the war for the... Really, he knew that they wanted a transistor, but all they knew were there were strange electronic effects in classes of compounds, including the silicon, which not a compound, but it was a polycrystalline material that had been used as a detector for radar in World War II. And he wanted to explore those, and I think he had in mind that you might have an amplifier. And if you think about it, I mean, here's the telephone company. We had a million employees within a few years. And we had a network all over the whole country. And it all depended upon electrical signals being amplified and so forth. And you're going to do all that with vacuum tubes. That's doing it the hard way. And if you could get a solid state amplifier, it would revolutionize communications and all of electronics. And so he put this group together in the end of the war, 1945, December of 1947, they made the first transistor. And I think it's arguably the greatest invention of the 20th century, because everything that you now think of in the way of electronics and all of that is derived from the invention of the transistor. Without the transistor, none of it would have happened. The whole computer revolution and all the other electronic things that are changing life today, communication and so forth. So they invented it, but Shockley, Bill Shockley, who is a controversial person, but a real genius, he's a theoretical physicist. He had some odd ideas about race, which got him into hot water after he went out to Stanford to be a professor. But Shockley didn't think it was necessary to have single crystals. They could do everything they wanted with polycrystalline germanium. So the genius who had put this group to work inventing the transistor
didn't see how important it would be to have single crystals. And two or three chemists at Bell Labs, and under Bob Burns' aegis, went to work to make the first single crystals of germanium. And then it proved to be such a great thing when they finally did. Gordon Teal ended up going to Texas Instruments, made the first one. It was in the laboratory across the hall from the Bell Labs. And they made these single crystals, and then everybody knew as semiconductors began to develop. Shockley worked out the whole business of PN junctions, N-type, P-type, semiconductors, the doping, all of this. And that's all chemistry. It's chemistry to do it. The transistor itself and the qualities of a PN junction were physics. But making this stuff, you had to have high purity majority, you had to have single crystals, it had to be free of defects, free of all kinds of very small quantities of things that would kill the electronic action. And that was a job for chemists. So just there were more people who were chemists working on semiconductors all through the years than physicists, although the idea of the transistor had come from physics. And but everybody could see that silicon was going to be better than germanium, and that's because what's called the energy gap between the electronic band that's filled with electrons and the empty one up behind, and you want to promote a few. That was a bigger gap, so silicon was going to move it. Be usable at a higher temperature than germanium. Germanium was just barely usable if the thing warmed up. And furthermore, the mobility that we this in silicon was very high. That is, the electrons and holes move very rapidly in a field. So silicon was obviously the material we wanted, but it was very difficult to handle. And nobody could make single crystals. They couldn't make a transistor. So I went to work and as a masquerading as an analytical chemist and designed a mass spectrograph to analyze solids. It ended up later as a commercial instrument that was sold to people for various things. But I worked at that for a couple of years and published that. And then one of the your books, the young lady who had solicited a photograph from
Oh, yeah.
She had, there was a picture of it in, yeah. in there, the one that, well, it came, that certainly didn't solve all the problems, but it gave some useful information. And then they asked me, there were people working around Bell Labs in research on silicon trying to do this or that, probably a dozen or two. All the big effort was on germanium still. And powers that be asked me to coordinate the research on silicon. That was a concept that hadn't quite occurred to me before, which was to do some work of my own, but to go around and try to goad people into doing work that would reinforce the work of the others. And I had a small group of people, very talented, two or three fellows who were going to try to grow single crystals. That work had been started by Gordon Teal. You remember I told you he'd done the germanium work. And then Gordon Teal, going to a greater opportunity as he saw it, meaning more importance than financial things. Gordon was a good friend of mine. He went to Texas Instruments because they wanted to lure somebody who knew this way to TI. And so I was coordinating the silicon work at that point. And I had this group of crystal growers, and we were trying to grow single crystals of silicon.
Well, we, I guess I'd have to look it up to find out what year it was. It was probably about 53. We made a silicon transistor. And as far as we know, it was the first one. Well, TI and Kurt Deal down there with the materials work, they made one too. And so we have to call it the tie for the first silicon transistor, because we and they first reported our construction of a silicon transistor at the same meeting in back-to-back papers. It was the IRE, which was the Institute of Radio Engineers in Minneapolis, and the TI people had sort of forgotten that it was back-to-back papers. But anyway, it was. So they and we, running neck and neck, made the first silicon transistor. And as you, I'm sure you know, pretty soon silicon took over the world and still owns the world. And so I think that was probably my individual technical contribution. I don't mean that I made that transistor, although I'm one of the authors on the paper, the first paper. That was largely because I was guiding the materials work. And in terms of its importance, ultimately the project that we were on was, you know, somebody else would have done it, but somebody has to do it first. And we and TI did. TI gets, is in the popular mind much more likely to be thought of, and the reason was that they made a transistor radio base, and they were selling a little radio. The telephone company wasn't, they couldn't sell anything like that, so we were going to have to put it into telephone equipment. So they had the first commercial use of it. And I give them, right, TI had a lot of good people, and they deserve a lot of credit. But it wasn't of interest to us to make a little radio. But the fundamental thing was to get the silicon transistor. And then my course was set as far as my contribution to technical work. It was the solid state work, as we called it. Let me just say a little bit more about that. At that time, at the end of World War II, I don't know how the people were divided up in physics, but a tiny fraction of them were in what we call solid-state physics, because they were in gaseous electronics or something. You know, these are the people who are looking at the flight of electrons through space and, you know, through gas discharges. Or then very soon after the war, they got into nuclear physics. Not yet high energy, but nuclear physics. And they were all in nuclear physics, really sopped up. Probably well over half of the physicists were that. There weren't any solid-state physicists around. After the invention of the transistor, probably within 5 years, a third of all physicists in the country were working in solid-state physics. But the chemists had all kinds of other things that were on their plate, plastics and everything under the sun. So while an awful lot of people went into, chemists went into, and metallurgists too, into the materials aspect, it never achieved the same unique position in chemistry that solid-state physics had in its larger field. So I spent a lot of time in subsequent years promoting the idea that solid-state chemistry was an important field, because there were just as many people in chemists who were doing this kind of thing as there were physicists over there doing their solid-state physics, but we didn't have anything. The American Chemical Society, if you sent them a paper in solid-state chemistry, they didn't have any place to put it, and they couldn't have cared less. They just passed the thing by completely, all of this business. They didn't recognize it as something that would be of interest. They had too many other things they wanted to do. And the Physics Society, American Physical Society, started off with that attitude, but they changed pretty fast when their meetings began to be dominated by the advances in solid-state physics. It didn't happen for the chemists. And the home for a solid-state chemist was hard to find in the professional societies. And the person, my friend R.M. Barings, my patron, he was an electrochemist. And he was a big wheel in the electrochemical society. And he saw that electrochemistry was not growing. I mean, you know, how many people can you put in batteries and corrosion and electroplating and so forth? And so he was trying to figure out how to do that. And he saw this as a field that the Electrochemical Society should look on as a possibility for them. I mean, you know, sort of electrons through. So he urged the sponsorship of the Electrochemical Society of Symposia. And they were the first society and long-time leader in providing a home for the solid-state chemist. And in fact, within a few years, half of the Electrochemical Society was doing solid-state chemistry.
Hmm. You've mentioned a number of things I wanted to go back to. Let's go back, all the way back to the mass spectrometer. The mass spectrograph for solids. Is this, I'm trying to go back to the Bell Lab culture again. Was this an idea you conceived? You knew the problem, the analytical problem of determining very minute quantities in solids.
Mm-hmm.
And were you free to say, I would like to try this?
Oh, yes. It was well known, you know, it was common scuttlebutt around there that, well, somebody's got to figure out what's the matter with silicon. Why aren't we able to do anything with silicon? And my supervisor and I talked it over, and a paper had been written by a couple of people at the University of Chicago during the war, Shaw and somebody. And they had built a mass spectrograph to analyze, these were nuclear materials. And they had published a description of the paper in the Journal of Scientific Instruments or something, or maybe Journal of Applied Physics. And we called them and asked them about this thing because they were determining trace impurities in solids. Well, yeah, they had used the thing for a couple of weeks, but they'd gotten so highly radioactive with long-life isotopes that they had to take it out in the desert and bury it. But they'd be glad to talk to us about it. So my supervisor and I took the train out to Chicago and went to visit these guys. And they said, here, we'll give you diagrams of the things we did. And we talked all over with them and so forth. And I came back all fired up to see if I couldn't build one that would be somewhat similar to theirs and use it on silicon. And that's what triggered off the whole thing.
Okay.
But it wasn't immediately apparent to everybody, gee, this is a brilliant idea. I know the director of research, we're going to have to spend some money on this thing. It wasn't a cheap thing to build. And there was somebody that had some other project in mind, and the director of research called us in, the small group, four or five. He wanted to hear these two proposals about what we thought we were going to do. And Shockley came in, and I proposed this mass spectrograph. Well, Shockley said, we don't need it because we can do everything we want with polycrystalline silicon and so forth. And here's a great man doing that. But Ralph Bowne, who is the director of research, listened to him skeptically. He knew Shockley and knew he shouldn't believe everything he said. Well, anyway, the upshot of that meeting was that I got the green light to go ahead and start this. But it was a project that took, certainly more than a year to build a machine. And I didn't have any background in mass spectrographs there. So I had to, in fact, I went up to Wesleyan University where there's a fellow measuring masses very precisely and asked if I could come up and watch him with his machine and maybe play with it a little bit. It was used for precise measurements of masses of isotopes. So I went up there. I spent probably maybe 2 weeks up there at Wesleyan University, and he was very friendly and gave me all kinds of help. Ended up with a good friend of mine, Harry Duckworth, Canadian. So that was, you know, the kind of preparation, because these were not common machines, and the only one that had ever been built for analytical purposes was the one that was buried out in the desert. And the Chicago people weren't about to do it again. So I went to work on it, and in retrospect, gee, I was really, it took a lot of temerity, a lot of ignorance on my part to plunge ahead with a project like this, because I really didn't, there were all kinds of problems that hadn't been solved, but it worked. In fact, there were two different models, completely different approaches to the mass spectrographic analysis, and the source, how do you get the ions into the fields and so forth, and I started two of them simultaneously. The other one came to grief. It wasn't working very well, and it was going to have to be redesigned and so forth. And so the one that ultimately worked, the one that's cited, was came along, and it worked. So I dropped the other and quietly shelved that part of the project.
How much reporting would you have had to do along the way in a project like this?
Very little. My supervisor had, he knew, certainly, and there was no formal reporting. He'd ask me when he'd see me, which, you know, how's it going? I'd go and talk over problems with it and him and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember, maybe out of curiosity, his boss might come once in a while to, in a friendly way, to ask how things are going, but there wasn't any reporting as such. And my relationships with my supervisor were such that it was terribly informal, and I'd go to him right away with problems that I had, and he was very willing to give all the help he could, but it was more as a more experienced researcher. It wasn't any grilling or anything of the sort. It was just, he obviously felt some degree of responsibility because he'd obviously recommended that we do this. Mm-hmm. And so he had a stake in it too. A fellow named Joe Burton, he was a chemist and a fine person and very smart, very modest.
Did you have any, you had these informal discussions going on a lot. Did you have any more formal seminar or research group meetings where you shared your ideas and what was going on?
No.
Okay.
We really didn't. It was a very informal place. There was very little requirement that things be reported up the line periodically or on some sort of a schedule or anything. Obviously, word filtered up. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that chemical director would ask, and it would get asked, what's happened to Bruce Hanna? Is he doing anything? Or how is he getting along? And they'd say, oh, it's all right. It's still going. It's a tough one. But, you know, I'm sure he was aware of what was doing. But it wasn't because he came around or I had to march up and mm-hmm. give a report. So it was a very supportive environment. But again, as I say, you could have enjoyed yourself right up to the point where you failed, totally. And I can only say that the people that I saw in my line of supervision, I would have had a hard time finding people that I had more respect for, or it was a very comfortable group of people, but boy, they, you know, you really, it encouraged you to work very hard at success. You mm-hmm. really, I'm sure that system was getting the most out of people. It wasn't scaring them, but you could figure out that you know, the challenge, it's up to you. And a great bunch of people.
Let me ask you a more general question in this sense. Did you ever have a case where you worked on an idea that you knew was not going to succeed? And how did you handle
it? Well, of course, in a project like that, management, we have things that weren't going to succeed. I didn't have any worry about dropping them. Well, I mentioned I had started two designs at once, and I was getting them made. I told my supervisor, I said, I have this other thing isn't working, and he gave me some advice about that, and we talked about it. But I'd say, I'm going to push this other one. I don't think this, if I could get one out of two, that's better than zero out of two. But it wouldn't have made sense to go on with that. So I never had any feeling that, at least with him, and he was obviously the primary management contact. I have to say that for the first 3 or 4 years, I probably didn't know the name of the president of Bell Labs or maybe the vice president of research. You didn't, there wasn't some mighty figure that was towering over you. And so I didn't have any hesitation about saying where I was in trouble and so on. I might tell a little story, which is kind of sequence and contact, but later on when I was in the job that R.M. Burns had, the chemical director, I went off and visited some European chemical companies, including the Germans, the three pieces of E.A. Farben, the principal ones. And one of them, I wouldn't quote a name, but it was Otto Bayer, who was the director of research at Bayer. I went in, and we had good relations with companies all over the world because we were not competitors, we were cross licensees. And I was going to spend the day seeing what they're doing at Bayer in way of research that related to the solid state interests that we had. And I was first ushered up to this, they had this great edifice, about a 12-story new building that was their research laboratory. And he had the top floor, and it's the biggest office I'd ever seen. You could hardly see across it. And not only that, he was a big man, and he had the big cigar, which was the biggest cigar I'd ever seen. And so we talked for a little while, and we talked about, and he was interested in me. And, Bell Labs didn't mean a lot to him because they were a chemical company. But I asked him about the kind of people that they hired. Well, we hire only PhDs in chemistry. Well, we only hired PhDs too. But he said they had to have 2 years of postdoctoral work. Then they'd hire them. And I said, what do you do when they come and report for work? Do they just work on a project that they pick out and so forth? Oh, no, I wouldn't let them do that. I'd tell them what to do. And I thought, boy, that's a different system.
Well, leads me then to the question of the silicone business, because
silicon. Well, that's a common silicone. Silicon, the average person who hasn't been in the semiconductor business hears a lot more about silicone than about silicon.
Well, I've done interviews with Frank Hyde and Earl Warwick, who were silicone pioneers.
Yes.
So I have to watch my terminology. But when you were asked to coordinate the silicon as a material, the development of silicon as a material, was that something new?
Well, we'd been through the thing with germanium and knew that single crystals are germanium. By this time, Shockley was on board and said we need single crystals of silicon.
Okay.
And Shockley thought the way to do it was to hire a mechanical engineer, and he hired him, told him to design an equipment that would grow single crystals of silicon. And this guy had under construction a very expensive crystal growing machine that was doomed to failure. It couldn't possibly work. But that was because Shockley didn't know anything about materials. And this guy was the wrong guy to be doing it. He was just designing things. But this coordination was in the following sense. Here are a couple of physicists over here, and they're measuring lifetime. You inject carriers, electrons, or holes into a semiconductor. How long do they last before they recombine? That's crucial to the utility of the And the thing that causes them to recombine is usually an impurity in there, and it may be at a concentration of 10 to the minus 7 or 10 to the minus 8. We called those that element dethmium because we didn't know what it was. And as an example of the kind of trouble you got into, the first crystal growing machines for germanium had lots of copper in them. Well, copper turns out to be good number one dethmium in silicon. Mm-hmm. You can't stand a trace of any copper in there. You have to design it completely differently. Furthermore, the crucibles that were used for melting the germanium, graphite crucibles, you try to melt silicon in it, 500 degrees hotter, set 500 degrees, 1400 and something instead of 900 and something, and it just dissolved that whole crucible. So we were using silica quartz crucibles, but we had to unravel these things. What's the stuff in here that's causing the thing not to work? You know, the carriers can't flow. How do we dope the thing? How do we handle the thing? How do we make crystals that are not filled with lattice defects? Just a whole maze of problems. Well, we're working on materials, and other people measuring, they get the best crystal or best sample, solid sample that they could, because they wanted to study the behavior of carriers in there and how long do they last and so forth. And other people were trying other experiments, physics experiments, but they're working with material which is poor. It's under poor control because it hasn't been purified. We don't understand the role of which impurities are in there. And so my job coordinating was to go around and try to encourage people who seem to have a clue as to what to do, you know, to help them by mm-hmm. offering, for example, to make samples for them and work with them. Some people trying to make a transistor out of it, but it was hopeless at that time. And there were all kinds of things. One of the most troublesome things was if you even heated the silicon, it changed type. There were all kinds of changes in the electrical behavior of it and even the type of semiconductor it was, which came about just from heating it. Well, it was a very mysterious thing, and there were a couple dozen people working on this and that phase of silicon around, but all with a material that didn't behave properly. I was dealing with the DuPont company because we got our raw silicon from them. They had made it for radar detectors in World War II. We offered to buy 500 pounds of it if they'd go put the thing on the road again and mm-hmm. so forth. And that was the purest silicon we could find, but it was obviously highly contaminated. So I was talking to the DuPont people to try to... So I'm just trying to give some idea what the coordination amounted to, okay. was to try to get what I could, and I wasn't in a position of authority, but only allowed to go around and try to persuade people, often who were had more seniority than I did, to, why don't you try this or that? Can I do anything to help? And that sort of thing. But the belief was that this was an unconnected effort on the part of various people. So they put this young guy, me, to work, seeing if he couldn't try to help bring some order out of this effort. And but the sort of central thing was I had these crystal growers reporting to me, and I hired a couple of other people. Anyway, we worked away at it, and by 53 or so, we were through the proof of feasibility for the transistor, and from there on, everybody knew that silicon was going to be the thing. So we were off and running, not because we had solved all the problems, but at least we knew that the goal was attainable and that silicon was going to be material of the future. And within several years, germanium was really phased out, and silicon has remained since then the material for all integrated circuits. You know what an integrated circuit is? It's just a transistor with a whole collection, maybe a million transistors in it and a million diodes or something like that. You know, it's but it's just an array of them on a little chip, as they call it now. But it's a slice of single crystal silicon.
There's still a piece of ENIAC sitting at the Electrical Engineering Laboratory at Penn, and I've seen it, and it's just an amazing thing to see what
I've seen pictures of it.
Yeah.
Built the first electrical computer. That was before the ENIAC. And he made it with telephone switches. You know, a whole bunch of electromechanical switches in an array of them. This would close, that would close, and so forth. And, it was really a crude thing. You know, it could add a few numbers, and that's about all it could do.
you had mentioned that many of the people you were dealing with had more seniority than you did, and you were still quite young at this point.
Yeah.
You were, what, 20?
Well, we were doing that in...
Well, 30, you were maybe.
Let's see, 53, yeah. I was getting on toward 30, but I was born in 1921, so the bulk of this work was in
the late 50,
53, 54, and so forth. And we, I think, published the first... our first paper and some other things that came out of our work, a group of papers, and I think they were probably published in late 53 or early 54.
Okay. What I'd want to ask then was there any resentment to your being this coordinator?
Because I didn't have any authority, you know, I couldn't reward them or punish them. All I could do was to groan and urge them to do something, and they could tell me to go fly a kite if they wanted. But we were a very cooperative bunch, and they would badger me, you know, why can't you make some crystals that are any good? The stuff that you're giving us is lousy. So it was a give-and-take kind of thing. But what had been seen was, is this effort to produce the materials feeding into reasonable experiments and so forth, and, you know, to exercise some judgment on that? No, I didn't see any resentment, maybe because I was too innocent to notice. But I'd say the level of cooperation and... a friendly, cooperative relationship was notable, very notable. You know, we were all in together. We wanted to be first.
I would think that in a situation, in an environment where you have all this flexibility and freedom, there might be a tendency to carve out a turf and lay claim to...
Some of them would do that, but that would... no turf was assigned... irrevocably to anybody, and if somebody else wanted to go in and said, I can think of a better way of doing it, they could go in, and so you might find that there's some internal competition. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily doing it exactly your way, just saying that they've got more dexterity than you have and will do the experiment right, but because if they have a different idea, let them try it, and let the better idea win. So there was no... Bell Labs always took the attitude, if we know you're working in a field, that doesn't give you exclusive right to work. It gives you a right to work in that field. If you say you're going to want to do it, fine, we'll let you do it. But you don't own the field.
Okay.
Because you couldn't exclude other people from it. But we would exercise a reasonable amount of control. Supposing other people say, I want to go in, I think I work more hours and I'm smarter than so-and-so. But sometimes, even with that situation would hold, and we'd encourage somebody else to come in and give some competition.
So, but I wasn't the one making such decisions. I might report that to my boss, and they might, you know, because I was reporting to them all the time, who's accomplishing something and who isn't, and, you know, we're failing to do something or other because it's too hard for these guys. They're not, we're undermanned in an area. But it wasn't a team activity in the sense that there was a czar over it all.
Okay.
Because we did have the example of germanium. And everything that we knew about germanium, we wanted to know that about silicon. But it, a lot of the concepts had been found in germanium. And I never had anything to do with germanium. My job was to start with the silicon.
Okay.
And because very straightforward elementary physical principles told us that silicon was going to be better than germanium. And when it came along, it swept germanium out to the pastures.
As I understand it, one of the problems with the silicon was the dissolved oxygen, which
yes.
you got around
oh,
with the...
That was the heat treatment, oh yes. And that drove me out of my mind, and everybody else, we couldn't understand, because you take a crystal of silicon, you want to heat it for something, maybe to diffuse an impurity in and make a layer, and the thing would change. The first transistor we did, because we found this heat treatment effect, we would dope the thing, and then we'd heat it and cook it, and it formed a p-n junction and a thin layer there, and we made a transistor out of it by using this mysterious effect. Well, I hired a fellow. By that point, I had arrived at the point where I was a supervisor of a small group, and I hired a fellow named Wolfgang Kaiser, who was a German physicist, a very thick German accent. And he had come to this country, a lot of Germans then, because German institutions were pretty well wiped out, and he'd come, and he was working at the Signal Corps Laboratory in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. And that wasn't a very inspiring place to be. It was all right, you know, it was a good laboratory, but the Signal Corps brought him over, and he did spectroscopy, and understood something about, he was interested in silicon, he was doing some spectroscopy on silicon. Well, I hired him. We asked him if he'd want to be interviewed, and yes, he did, and I hired him, and he came up, and he found that this silicon we had was filled with oxygen. Why? We were melting the stuff in a silica crucible, and the silicon would etch enough of the oxygen out of the silica, and it was doping it with oxygen. And the oxygen was electrically active in the thing, and we had to get it away from that. Holy smoke, that really made a difference, because he cracked that problem. He, Wolfgang Kaiser, good friend of mine today. But anyway, and he did it by doing the infrared. He found the frequencies that were silicon-oxygen bonds, which were clearly identifiable for a spectroscopist. And he said, this filled with these silicon, you know, bending frequencies and everything. He found them all. So, then I took one of the best of the crystal growers, and we talked about it. And another German had done something that was called the floating zone method. And that was to grow a crystal without a crucible. And you take a rod of the stuff and put a coil around it and move it slowly through that. You produce a molten zone. The surface tension kept it from running down the sides. And you pass it through the whole thing slowly. Floating zone, you can see the zone, molten zone, between the two solid ends, which are clamped at the ends, moves through the thing. And we started to grow, because now it's not in contact with silica.
Mm-hmm.
And when we did that, we set that up, cobbled together a floating zone apparatus, and we immediately got rid of all these heat treatment effects. And today, that's floating zone is growing that way. And these things, which were, oh,
less than a half an inch in diameter, and they look pretty ratty things, and they may be this long and maybe a good section like that. It looks like a billy club now, and it may be this diameter, and it may be 5 feet long, and it's been handled that way. It looks as though it's been turned out on a machine. And it's a single crystal of silicon with precisely controlled properties and so forth. And the floating zone thing is, you know, that's the way. You don't bring the molten silicon in contact with anything except the vacuum. I presume it won't take long to do it. Working at Bell Labs had a unique advantage over any other research laboratory, really. And that was the key to some of our success. We were a monopoly. The telephone company, as you remember, the Bell System, being a monopoly, nobody else could go into the telephone business. And, I mean, we carefully encouraged the little companies, helped them, which meant that if we made an invention like the transistor, we would immediately license it to all comers. Because if you stop and think about it, we could, I told you, we couldn't make a transistor radio, and they couldn't make telephone equipment. By telling them freely what we did, letting them come visit us, look through the lab, and so forth. In fact, we had a symposium, and anybody, any company, could come to that and fill the auditorium with it on the transistor and explain all the stuff that we knew and had learned. And it was right in the first days of the transistor. But we got cross licenses out of it. Because the fear, if you're a monopoly, is that somebody else, they could hold us up. We couldn't hold anybody else up because the Justice Department wouldn't let us. Mm-hmm. Well, we could license them, but it had to be at a reasonable rate. But if they got something, they could have held us up if something we needed. Therefore, we got cross licenses. And when I was later on Vice President of Research and Patents, we had licenses around the world with maybe 800, 900, 1,000 companies, every company that you could think of. That didn't mean it was an even trade always. Usually they paid us some monetary sum in there. But it wasn't a money-making proposition. It just paid for our licensing operations and the lawyers. But that made a tremendous, that meant I could go into any laboratory of any of those companies around the world, all the Japanese laboratories, I could go into Hitachi and NEC and so forth, could go into the German laboratories, could go into the British laboratories, wherever there was work, ask Bell to visit. Oh, sure, because they wanted to visit us. So that was it. In terms of information flow, the work of the world, is supposing somebody made an improvement in the transistor, we're licensed on it. We only benefit from having somebody else capitalize on our invention, because they're going to use it for some commercial purpose that we are excluded from, and we can bring it back to us, and we can go and visit them in the lab. That's a tremendous advantage. When I said I'd talk to a buyer, you know, we could go to any place. They were licensed. They were licensees of ours. Everybody was. And that is one thing. And the other thing I was going to mention, I think it was in 1954, I became a supervisor, or what we call a sub-department, it's called a department head now, of a group of maybe a dozen or so PhDs in physical chemistry, or maybe physics, a couple of them, some of them, two or three of them. Because it really, as early as that time, and it flowed out of my experiences in this coordination, I decided that I really enjoyed the management side of things. Not that as coordinator I'd been a manager, but I could see my spending my life more in a supervisory role where I could get my hands in lots of things than holding up in a laboratory, partly because I thought I would be better at it, and looking back on it, I think there was no question about it. I could do that more successfully than I could have been able to expect as an individual scientist. I mean, I would have loved to have been a spectacularly successful individual scientist, but I just knew I was better at the other, and I enjoyed it more. So it was about that stage that I made the choice that was going to be to follow the management route, and I went from that to, you know, up the pyramid over the years.
Okay, that was one of my questions, so I'm glad you put that in.
In fact, I got promoted every 6 years. It turned out it's generally from 54, and then February 1st, 1961, it probably would have been. I got made chemical director 1967, February 1st. I became executive director of all the materials work, which was metallurgy and a whole bunch of things. And that was 67. And maybe it was 72 or 73, I became vice president of research and patents. So it was sort of 6 years.
Why don't we talk about that a little bit? I wanted to come, well, let me hold on that for a moment.
Sure.
The late 1950s, before you really got into the full more serious management, research management, you were continuing, the transistor was announced in 53, but is this the time when the gallium arsenide work started?
Yeah, and the gallium arsenide work got started, and that was when I had this group of a dozen or so people, and the early semiconductors that were known were 2,6 compounds, you know, zinc sulfide, and things that were phosphors in the luminescent materials. And then along had come germanium. But that triggered off a smart German named Welker, who was at Siemens, and he had suggested the 3,5 compounds. And they weren't easy to make, but the easiest ones to make were the ones with the narrow band gap, indium, antimonide, and so forth. And Welker published paper, and he had some crude things. He didn't have single crystals, and he didn't have good, particularly good measurement. But it certainly laid out the whole thing, and he deserved the credit because it was Welker who thought of the 3,5s. They had the same crystal structure as the germanium, silicon, if you just alternate all the atoms. But the atoms in their relationship to each other, if you never mind the identity of the particular one, are laid out the same way. Mm-hmm. Zinc blend, lattice, same as the diamond. Well, and then the work, Welker had gone on and done something else, and people had tried a little bit of this, but nobody was really working on it. So when I had this group, I said, we ought to get to work on the best of the prospect of these. And I studied the thing at some length as to which would be, and I came to the conclusion that gallium arsenide was the most promising of the 3,5 compounds. So who's going to do this thing? Well, there was a fellow in metallurgy who had been working on the floating zone silicon, and I'd worked with him on that. And he was very unhappy in there for other reasons. The people he was working with, he felt it just wasn't a happy relationship. So I cautiously inquired about his interest in coming over to my group and explained what I wanted. And he was experienced at growing silicon crystals, and he showed great interest in doing that, and so we did things properly through channels and so forth. And the upshot of it was that he transferred over to my group for the explicit purpose of working on the gallium arsenide, which I'd asked him to do. And he set to work to do it with floating zone and so forth. And eventually he was making gallium arsenide crystals and so forth. As far as we knew at the time, we were the only people in the United States, or maybe in the world, who were working on gallium arsenide. And it turned out we were the only ones in the United States working on a 3,5 at that point. The other things, like indium antimonide, that were maybe useful, maybe not useful as detectors for infrared, but, you know, nobody cared about that. We wanted to make transistors. And remember, the laser hadn't yet been invented. Mm-hmm. It turned out,
after we were well into this, had made single crystals of gallium arsenide, made some observations about it. Nobody's ready to claim we could make transistors out of it yet, but we were trying to make the transistor. We discovered that there was a fellow in England, Cyril Hilsum, who was at the SERL, which is the Service Electronic Research Laboratory, it's a government laboratory. He had been thinking very much the same way as we had. So independently, we had both gone to work on gallium arsenide, and we were at about the same place. We visited back and forth, and he came. He's a fine fellow. So we can't claim that we were unique, but the Germans weren't working on it anymore. So only that British laboratory and my group were working on gallium arsenide, and we were going to make a gallium arsenide transistor. Well, we were struggling along. We got diodes made and so on. Meanwhile, a Bell Labs alumnus and a fellow at Bell Labs came up with the laser. And to our eternal embarrassment, somebody else found some things about the energy band structure of semiconductors that told us why you couldn't make a laser out of silicon, but you could out of a 3-5 compound. So we weren't the first to make a laser out of gallium arsenide. There were three other laboratories that did it simultaneously, the Lincoln Lab and GE and somebody else. Maybe it's IBM. And that was a bad thing, but anyway, you know, you can't win them all. But we had the gallium arsenide. We made it. And so then gallium arsenide took off like a rocket because it was the preferred material for lasers. And as I say, that isn't what we'd made it, gallium arsenide in the first place, thinking it was going to take over transistors just as silicon displaced germanium. But here we had this new use, the laser, which was the excitement. This was in the, I'd have to look up the year, but it was the early 60s. And later on, we did, in fact, make gallium arsenide transistors. They didn't sweep silicon away, though, because silicon got better and better. And gallium arsenide got better and better. But silicon was always moving along. You know, it was getting to be a better material, purer and so forth. So it turned out that you could do just about everything you wanted to do with silicon. And gallium arsenide, which would work at a higher frequency than silicon, there weren't enough uses to make it a big competitor for silicon, and it was obviously inherently a more difficult material to work with. So why work with that when you can achieve what you want with silicon? You only use it where you have to use it. I've explained why for a laser, silicon doesn't work even. But for the transistor uses, silicon remained the king. But gallium arsenide was good. But that's how that we got into the gallium arsenide business. So I had the right ideas on it, but the transistor came along with me belatedly. And I don't claim that I invented the concept of gallium arsenide. It was the German, Welker. But they had dropped it, and everybody else had dropped it, and only the fellow in England and my colleague and I stuck with it.
Were there any other things in the late 50s before you became chemical director that you were working on, or was the gallium arsenide principle?
I'd say that in one of the semiconductors, I was very interested in pushing the concept of solid-state chemistry as a subject, you know, defects in solids. I went around giving lectures on this subject and on lecture tour for the American Chemical Society and so forth. Because we did I'm making it sound as though I was a participant in it, but some of the people in that group that I had did some remarkable things because they could show that you could take electrons and holes and apply all the mass action laws that were known to chemists, where you had hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions, and all the equations, everything worked. All your old electrolyte things, a semiconductor is nothing but that same thing, and it's the electrons and the holes that are the counterparts of those. Mm-hmm. Mass action, everything applies. And so it turns out that a chemist understands a great deal of the things that are going on in the solid, but it certainly wasn't apparent at first. Well, two or three of my colleagues pushed this, and we promoted the whole idea because it was obviously chemistry that we were doing.
The first chapter of the book you edited on semiconductors describes that.
Yeah, that's right. It's in that.
I was looking at it and saying, my gosh, applying mass action to this was...
Well, you know, the physicists, they knew that they could multiply the hole and electron concentrations together, and they ended up with a constant, but it never occurred to them. They never heard of mass action. And the chemist who was, a theoretical chemist who was primarily the one who triggered all this off, was a fellow named Howard Reiss, R-E-I-S-S, who, last I heard, was still a professor at UCLA, and a very good friend of mine. But we had a, gee, it was fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We had a marvelous time with this, and I'd participate. My job in there, where I was the supervisor of this group, was not to tell them what to do, but to encourage them, and they could bounce ideas off me, and I'd make suggestions and so forth. And I had my satisfactions out of having this whole thing flourish. It was really a red hot group. We were publishing, and people were winning prizes. One of the people who was in that, they made the first silicon solar cell. That was in my group. That was Cal Fuller.
Cal Fuller, yes.
Yeah, you know Cal Fuller.
Yes,
Cal Fuller had been a polymer chemist.
Right.
And then he switched over to semiconductors. He'd had some unhappiness in the polymer business and just dropped polymers entirely. He'd been a department head, like me, but I don't know the history. But in any case, he came over and he was in this group. And he was the guy who put together the first...
Sure.
Silicon solar cell.
Mm-hmm. And he won a big award for that. I forgot.
Oh, yeah, they won a prize. We had people winning prizes all over the place. And it was always exciting times. I must say that those years in that with that bunch of people, they were really a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. We had a marvelous time.
How did things change when you became chemical director?
Well, I had more administrative responsibility. I guess the chemical research organization probably had 250 people in it or something like that. And it involved other things. You know, there would be a couple of polymer groups and so forth because solid-state chemistry was not in that.
Mm-hmm.
I was moved across over. I hadn't been in the chemical research. I'd been in what we call chemical physics research, smaller organization. And... So I had learned a lot of things. You know, they weren't hard to learn. There was a group on electrochemistry, and there was an analytical group, and there were two or three polymer groups, and so on. So I learned a whole lot of things. I learned not to call adhesives glue. But there were a lot of practical things, and the chemical research organization had an engineering function as well as a research function. Because all of the materials that went into the Bell system, manufactured in equipment manufactured by the Western Electric Company, which is one of the largest manufacturing companies in the country, those materials were specified by Bell Labs and by that chemical research thing. That is, we would write the specifications, and we would talk to Union Carbide or somebody about their polymers and what's the matter with their polyethylene, why we couldn't use that, or, you know, it had losses and... or something. So I got to know a lot of that, but I didn't find it difficult because, after all, it was chemistry, but it was just a different area of chemistry. However, it was a big enough group so that I couldn't expect to have a close watch on everything because there are just too many people doing too many different things.
And then when I moved to the next level, which was called executive director, and I wasn't stepping over vice president, then the other, it was not only the chemical research, but there was the metallurgical research and all the materials work, ceramics and everything else. And so as the organization got bigger and bigger, I knew less and less about more and more different things. and that, when I became vice president of research, then that really was the case, because I had that computer science and I had systems engineering and mathematics and behavioral sciences and some economics research and a whole lot of things. And then I really had to.
I've always been curious, when you get to that level, and you, as a scientist yourself, and you get further and further removed from really understanding the nitty gritty of what's going on, how do you feel about that? Do you feel
I told you I already expressed a preference for the management. It's not because I wanted to wield power or something, but I'd go over to the cafeteria and, by choice, not eat where the people who were, let's say, also the vice president of something or other would eat. I'd rather go out in the cafeteria and look around and see a familiar face of somebody in there and sit down and ask them about, what are you up to, and talk to them. And then I got a little big bang out of talking in a very informal way and with people, and they, I think, recognized that I was genuinely interested in what they were doing, and they could say anything to it. They could complain or badger me about anything or tell me what they were doing, and it was so I could feel a connection with what the place was all about. But I was not in an executive dining room. I was in the cafeteria and looking for anybody that looked familiar. And I learned a whole lot from them, and it was a good way to get the information about what's going on.
Sure.
And so I enjoyed that too, because it did give me contact with so many different things, and so much of it was new to me, the computer science, for example, and operations research, and all these things. Well, I was learning all about the things that were the wave of the future, as well as, in other words, I wasn't, at this point, I wasn't locked in as a chemist. I'd say, though, that as a chemist, and maybe I could contrast this to the mathematicians and the physicists, to their disadvantage, a chemist is used to messy, untidy situations, complexity. The physicist wants to reduce things to a simple system which he can solve exactly. And a mathematician has a mathematical purity about his thinking. But a chemist is much more ready to accept complexity and so forth, and somewhat untidy solutions to things, but they may be the best you can do, and you try to work your way up from that. So felt that a chemist had something to bring to the broad range of activities that we had. As a matter of fact, my predecessor as vice president of research was a chemist, and he was very well known, Bill Baker.
Oh, sure.
And Bill Baker had been vice president of research for 18 years, and then on top of, so for something like 27, 28 years, they had a chemist from Princeton in charge. First Bill Baker, and then myself. There were occasional complaints about the chemist having taken over in a place, in a laboratory that was not a chemical company, but that was, I never felt that I was handicapped in this, but it meant that I was continually challenged to learn new fields and to learn what it was about. And some of the things that I was most interested in when I was vice president of research
they might have involved raw material. For example, the optical fiber communication system. That was probably, when I was vice president, was the thing I pushed hardest and which I came to pass as, and came to fruition. And I was proud of it because I was really ready to pour any resources into the into that. I hate to think how much money we spent on it. Nobody ever asked me to account for it. And we poured money into it, and because I was absolutely convinced that it was going to be the whole system of the future, and the electrical engineers, systems engineers who were working on it, and so forth. And I had set up a group effort on the optical fibers to purify those, and gotten the Corning Company in, talked them into putting in an effort. But it was, you can see it in the fibers. That wasn't all that far removed from my previous experience with silicon, so the materials were coming in. But I had to know, why are we doing all of this, and why? It was very simple, but it seemed to me perfectly obvious that optical fibers would take over, and it's come out just that way.
Yes.
I think I probably, well, that's a rough guess. And those were earlier dollars. I'm sure, and the research budget, I must have spent $100 million on the on the optical fiber effort. Shoot, they got it all back in the first year. I mean, the telephone company, that was one of the things about working for a company that had worked with big big numbers.
This flexibility, this freedom we talked about earlier, did you still have that as you moved up the management this management level?
Yes, I really did. The system there, I really had the freedom. I mean, people were more aware, up the ladder were more aware of what was happening and so on. But I had the freedom to, well, we had certain responsibilities we had to discharge. For example, when I was chemical director, and we were responsible for the specifications for the polyethylene that was going to be used in insulation and so forth. Well, I had to make sure that we did the job and did it right. And that wasn't our, just because we chose to do it, it was because somebody had to do it and we had that responsibility. We had a number of assigned responsibilities that were recognized. We specified the materials that the Western Electric Company bought. And they might negotiate with several chemical companies and so forth, but it was to our specifications. But when we got, when I was vice president of research, for example, I decided that the computer science was the one thing we really had to start pushing. And so even when they put on a hiring freeze, I told the computer scientists, you hire anybody that's really good that comes along, and I'll find some way or other to cover it. It was a big enough organization, so nobody knew exactly what we were doing. So there was still plenty of freedom to do things, but you couldn't take the whole organization and say, well, we don't need any more metallurgists, just let's make them all computer scientists. You know, they don't turn into you, and if you're only hiring at a modest rate, it takes years to change the emphasis of the organization. But I could push it in certain directions by controlling the hiring. I'd get complaints from the people who I didn't give slots to, but that's the way it would work. So it was my judgment that really, but it was a reflection of the whole environment of what the Bell Labs engineering organizations were doing. I'm sure you know, it's an R&D organization, Bell Labs. It was. And research, which I had close to 1,500 people, and most of the scientific staff were PhDs. But it was only 15% of Bell Labs. The rest of it was all development. Mm-hmm. And they were specifying the equipment, designing and specifying the equipment that Western Electric would manufacture and deliver to the telephone companies. The only people that had the freedoms that we had were ourselves. We had not total freedom, but pretty close to it. Compared to
what I saw in other industrial research laboratories, we were in clover. We were. But again, it was the same thing. It was, as I said earlier, they give you the freedom, and it's and you can produce. The attitude of the AT&T company and the Bell Labs management was, okay, you had a great year this year, so we'll give you all the money that you had this before. See if you can do it again next year. I mean, you have a great year. What you really need to do is to keep producing year after year great new things. Mm-hmm. And as long as you're producing, fine.
You took an early retirement.
Oh, yes.
61, not 61, but 82.
Yeah,
I think.
Actually, it was 81. It's the end of 81. I went out of the job the rest of the time. I was cleaning out my desk or having retirement parties or something. I left in early 82. There was accumulated vacation and so forth. Well, I'd always thought that, you know, I might have burned myself out at that point. I was very close to the antitrust action because I had the patent organization. I had about 80 some lawyers in my patent organization. They were patent attorneys. Well, it turned out that for the various legal actions, antitrust and so forth, many of the questions about things that we were doing and the complaints about us revolved around rather esoteric technical questions. And the lawyer that was the most lawyers didn't know anything about these things. You could take a patent attorney. Well, he couldn't go into court and argue antitrust. He was the guy that could explain the technical reasons why you did certain things. So we were heavily involved. In the last couple of years there, I spent an awful lot of my time on antitrust with the patent attorneys that I had assigned to the this thing. But then the consent decree came along, and the Bell system was going to be broken up on the 1st of January 1984. And I said, I'm not going to be here then, because I've worked too hard to build, to maintain, I didn't start from scratch, but to build on the ideas of my predecessors and to do everything to ensure the quality of this organization. I'm not going to stay here. I said, there's no way that it isn't going to be broken up in time. It's going to be only an empty shell of its former self. I'm not going to be here. Mm-hmm. So I decided then and there, when the consent decree was announced, that I was going to retire early. And I did, a couple of years before then. Because it just wasn't attractive to take apart something that, you know, when you've been deciding how you're going to build this research organization. Now, the development people may have been less frightened by this because they're still going to be developing equipment and so forth. They may have more pressures on schedules or to listen to the salesman. But our freedoms, as we'd had them, shoot, that isn't going to survive in the long run. It's going to have to be scaled back. So I said, well, I only live once. I'm going to retire early. So I did retire early. Found myself for some years working harder than I did. First 2 or 3 years. I didn't think I was going to consult or anything, but I had a lot of friends in, partly because of this freedom of interaction with other organizations, other companies. Partly because I'd been active in the Industrial Research Institute, I'd been president of it, the IRI. And various people I knew who were typically the vice president of research at other companies, they approached me, and I hadn't gone around looking for any consulting, but I started getting consulting, and then I was invited to join boards and so forth. And the first 3 or 4 years, I remember I counted up one time. I said, my wife said, you're doing an awful lot of traveling. So I looked at my calendar, and I had made 36 round trips from the West Coast to the East Coast in the course of one calendar year.
What time did I see that plane?
It's 4:30.
4:30.
4:33 at least.
Yeah, that's what I said.
It's 3:30 now.
Yeah, well, it's not going to take an hour to get there, but I'm sure they'll have a taxi down there. And it really, they can drive it in 15 or 20 minutes, but I have to buy the ticket. So we probably... Are you going to go to the railroad station now, too?
Well, I am, but we'll see. I have to clean this up and check out. So if I don't go with you, I'll just go up later.
Yeah. I ought to leave at 10 or 5.
Okay.
5 of.
All right. Good. I'll watch and make sure.
I couldn't imagine what would take this much time, but it seems to me that you're clever keeping me talking. I've been spouting off about a whole lot of things.
It's been great.
And I don't know whether we've even begun to cover all the topics that you might have wanted to ask, but I consider that I've been very fortunate. You know, I worked at a great place. Now I look back on it, I can't imagine having worked at any institution that I had a greater affection for than Bell Labs. Mm-hmm. It was a great place to be. You know, exciting people, they were smart, and they were doing exciting things. And I enjoyed the management thing. I wasn't that I disliked science, far from it, but that was, you know, they were paying me to do the managerial work, which I thought was something I could do better than just being an individual scientist in the lab, but I had my contacts with all these scientists. It was just, and then after I retired from Bell Labs, and I left with only the warmest of feelings, but I didn't have a warm feeling toward the U.S. government. I still don't. But then I developed all kinds of interesting contacts with other companies. And you know, before I knew it, I was working with the vice president of research at Schlumberger and at Eastman Kodak, and I was on the board of Roman Haas and a whole lot of things.
I understand you and Howie Simmons.
Yeah, I know Howie Simmons.
Was that in his post-retirement period that you?
No, I'd known him before, and I was never a consultant for him, but I just happened to know him.
Okay.
A lot of them I knew from the Industrial Research Institute. Okay. But in the chemical industry, the person place that I had the most contacts with was the Roman Haas Company. But I joined their board soon after I retired. I guess I joined it before I retired. And then they asked me to be a consultant in addition, and I helped lure Bob Naylor away from DuPont and hire him as vice president of research. He was a terrific success. And also the Vince Gregory, who was, yes. You might know these people.
I met
Vince. Vince was the CEO, and he was a very forward-looking fellow, and he said, we've got to worry about environmental things and health, safety, and environment, and the board should do this. So he asked me, I was the only outsider who was a chemist by profession, so I was the chairman of the board committee on health, safety, and environment, and got some others in, and I brought in a couple of people from outside, Gil Ullman from the University of Washington, Dan Okun from North Carolina on water quality and so forth, contamination. So I spent an awful lot of time with the Roman Haas people. I got to know them very well and had great admiration for them. So I was a regular commuter to Philadelphia on one or the other of these board meetings. Maybe there were 9 or 10 a year. My committee, because we'd have to meet all day, we couldn't just do it in an hour in the morning on board, and consulting with Bob Naylor, I'd go out and he and I would review the work of all of his research people. So, you know, this was just fun, pure fun.
Mm-hmm.
And they paid me to do it, you know. But I was... but other places, you know, there weren't conflicts. I mean, there was not any overlap of interest. Just to take an example, the things I did for Jack Thomas at Eastman Kodak, they were really different. And I often got to know the CEO of these companies. I was consulting with Jack Thomas and met the CEO and the president of the company, who was later the CEO. Walter Fallon was the CEO, and Colby Chandler was the president.
And they said, we want you to come and consult with us, because their problem was, how are we going to move from an era in which film is things like razor blades and razor, you know, and Gillette, film and cameras. They were giving away cameras to sell film.
Mm-hmm.
They said, when it becomes electronic and people start storing the images on tape, what are we going to do at Eastman Kodak? We're not. It's going to be hard in the film business. So they wanted consulting activity on, from my electronics background, you know, what, and so they were different areas to focus on. As I would put it. And it was all fun. I learned so many different things from so many different things. I also spent a lot of time, probably Roman Haas and Atlantic Richfield were the two that I spent the most time with. Atlantic Richfield had been created by Bob Anderson, and he just merged other companies. He first got the Atlantic Refining and Richfield Oil Company. Later on, he brought in the Sinclair Oil Company, and they were all merged and so forth. And he was a nut on technology, so he was buying biotechnology companies and solar cells and everything. And when I was asked to chair an outside group that would advise them on science and technology, I think they had 17 different laboratories, mm-hmm. and they wanted to rationalize this. So I got to know, you know, the petroleum business, and I had some geologists and other kinds of people in this committee, and a very distinguished group of people. And it was, I'm trying to convey a sense of having had worked a lot of hours in my retirement years, but having a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it was just a pleasure.
You've also done some economics work with Ralph Landau.
Oh yeah, Ralph is a. In fact, I just got a letter from Ralph. He was asking me why I had disappeared. Ralph and I. See, I was a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Engineering. He was the National Academy of Engineering. I had agreed with Court Perkins, who was an aeronautical engineer, a professor at Princeton, was the president of it. And he asked me, wouldn't you like to be, I wasn't an engineer, but I sort of regarded myself as an applied scientist. Court said, how'd you like to be the foreign secretary of this? You know, they hadn't yet worked themselves up to having real elections. So I said, well, that's all right, you know, the foreign secretary. I thought that it would, I'd meet a lot of people from around the world and so on. Maybe I'd even get some foreign travel. It turned out that was a pain. But anyway, that, and Ralph, what the dickens was Ralph? Well, at one point he became the vice president of the NAE. But anyway, Ralph and I set up a committee for the National Research Council on innovation, industrial innovation, and what the U.S. government was doing to suppress it, to kill it, and so forth. And Ralph and I were kindred spirits on this. And we wrote some reports. We had a committee, anyway, or I was chairman of it, and Ralph was the noisiest participant. And we wrote some reports which did affect U.S. policy, and which called attention to the inhibiting effects of regulations and antitrust and so forth. And also we I decided we ought to analyze industries. So I picked a number of industries and we got experts on those, just the usual NRC things. We produced a series of volumes and so forth. So anyway, I saw an awful lot of Ralph because he was right in the thick of all of these mm-hmm. things, although they were really my projects. And I like Ralph. He's I wouldn't want to see him every day because he'd wear me out. But Ralph, if you know Ralph, he's right in the thick of things still. He got interested. He regards himself as an economist now, and he got a professorship at Stanford. I could say kind of an unkind thing. By giving them enough money, you know, you could be a professor of economics there, or I could if we had the money to give them that. Ralph made a smashing success as a chemical engineer. He started off with an idea that really paid off. So he was a terrific innovator, and talks about innovation all the time, but he'd had this one great big success which produced a company that made a pile of money, which was his company, it was his pile. And I like Ralph, and he's got an enormous amount of energy, and he's still active in the NAE and all these things in Washington. I got sick of it after about 7 or 8 years. I didn't want anything more to do with it. Too discouraging.
What I had sent you an agenda, and our time is running.
It's running
to the end. And we've covered virtually everything.
I hope we have, but I...
Let me just ask you about one thing. We haven't said scientific innovation in those terms, but I think we've covered that pretty well. What is important for the future vitality of chemical R&D? That's number 15 on that list.
Yeah, well, I feel that... Research and development organizations, industrial research and development organizations, everything flows down from the top. So it depends upon the guy at the top, you know, does he give the right kind of marching orders and does he watch this all very closely and so forth. Well, he's not going to get many bright ideas except when he happens to have the bright ideas himself. As I've described Bell Labs, it was much more of a bottoms-up approach. You hire the best people that you can, and you give them a working environment that brings them in, and they chose to come to you instead of going to MIT or someplace. You bring them in and turn them loose and see who can really make it and tell them, your job is to change things, change the world or something. Mm. And you sort people out on the quality of their ideas. I think that many of the, and this is an overstatement, in the chemical industry, they're too sure that it ought to work top down. Now, admittedly, the top has to be aware of what it's going to support, know why it's supporting it. But I think that they'd be surprised at how much they'd get out of it if they gave people more scope in what they did and so on. You know, you can afford, if you're spending a lot of money on this, Bell Labs wasn't spending a lot of its money on research. I told you that it was 15%, and that included a bunch of engineering things and so forth. So we could have pointed to all kinds of things that were ongoing projects with definite ends. We call them development. Many companies will call that research. We called it development. And when we said research, we meant research. And it was competitive with universities, not with... So I think that one thing that needs to be done is more people in the industry need to develop an open mind about this kind of approach to things. They claim that they do it, but they don't. And I hate to think how many good ideas that somebody might have are going to waste because they're not being encouraged to see how far they can go with them. Well, that's one thing that would, and certainly the spirit of inquiry into things I don't like the idea of just saying, here's, you know, our worry was more, we get something like a transistor or a laser, and everybody in the place wanted to go to work on it. We had to, how do we keep them out of it?
Okay.
So we didn't have to. My successor, who has a way with words, Arno Penzias, he put it very nicely. Hire the very best people you can, point them in the right direction, and get out of the way.
Yes.
Which is a pretty neat description of it.
Absolutely.
So to point them in the right direction, people very quickly sense what's going to make an impression around this place, and they can make a discovery that is completely foreign there and had nothing to do with the business of the company, and they know that it's not going to make, so they tend to say, what does this place really need? You know, what would, mm-hmm. I want to make myself a success here, a hero here. What would do that? I think I better.
Okay.
Well, listen, I didn't.
Well, I appreciate your spending the time with me this afternoon.
What's going to happen? You're going to.
I'm going to send you a transcript of this.
And you can. And if I want to add to it or you can, something,
right.
change it or
exactly.
from it,
exactly.
I you will can. Do that. And if you want to talk to me anymore, well, I think you're probably going to get a lot out of this, but I will try to do some sense about the balance of things. And,
all right. Well,